hierarchies in the same manner as Euro-Americans. Instead, their roles were interdependent, tribal leaders living with modernizing grandparents, a prostitute living at home whilst honing her medicine skills perhaps, or a girl managing the house for her hunting parents whilst keeping an appraising eye on the white man with material goods who shows a romantic interest in her. These malleable femininities were hard to discern for those who interacted with them directly. Travelers viewing the women in one moment in time took their intellectual snapshots, committed them to paper, and thus confined women to clearly defined parameters, even when actions showed that women did not conform to such gender boundaries. The way native women were described in early accounts varied a lot. Some writers projected European ideas of femininity onto them, portraying women as submissive, virtuous, or sexualized. Others, especially when describing ritual torture, avoided assigning motives or traits, almost as if they didn't know how to categorize them. Overall, these depictions were less about the women themselves and more about fitting them into roles familiar to Europeans, such as the romantic Pocahontas, the exotic seductress, the hard-working drudge, or the saintly convert. But when faced with women who didn't fit those molds, especially those seen as violent, the usual European framework for femininity broke down, revealing the limits of these stereotypes. Accounts of ritual violence demonstrate a tendency to focus on the lurid acts of torture. The behavior proved awkward for observers to mold into palatable presentations for Western consumption. As a result, there is far less imposition of conventional gendered characteristics on Indian women in such descriptions. Observations of the activities were accounts of actions that did little to illuminate the purposes of the acts or what women were expressing about themselves. Observers' opinions were vague, or even absent, as without the tools to make an assessment, explanations stalled at madness, fury, or savagery, Western explanations for female behavior that stepped outside conventional and approved boundaries. To 18th-century observers, the imposition of Western ideals meant that Indian women could be molded into something similar and comprehensible. For example, an Indian female's ownership of her body, and thus her sexuality, could be described as prostitution when she used it as a commodity for trade. Moreover, there were precedents for warrior women, often personifying patriotic feminine virtue as the mother of the nation, such as Boudica or Joan of Arc. The supposed calming influence of women was often viewed as a nurturing balance to the impulsive acts of men, perhaps allowing a small degree of white tolerance for Indian female political opinions in their capacity as mothers and wives. This permitted a historical acknowledgement of the position of Cherokee Chief Nancy Ward as a mother of the tribe, and her compassion was lauded when she saved the lives of those destined for torture. When she endorsed the torture of a young boy, however, contemporary commentators stalled, unable to find a way of interpreting her actions. For many European travelers, it was natural and appropriate to maintain the strict separation of war and home, i.e., male and female spaces. To these men, women's traditional link with deprioritized domestic areas rendered the Indian camp a place of non-violence, and it would logically follow that any violence performed by women in this area could not play a significant role in war. Of course, when women performed male tasks competently, they could no longer sensibly be identified as other, and so distinctions were maintained within the accounts that supported the status of males, swiftly dismissing such female behavior as deviant. Furthermore, to acknowledge the home camp as an arena of vital war activity would be to imbue women with unprecedented amounts of agency and will, their violent actions a direct challenge to notions of masculinity. In the first instance, violence in the Indian village would have been an intrusion of the masculine into the feminine arena. To assert that this was normal war practice would have been to discount the existence of a female area. It is unlikely that observers would have acknowledged a combined female and war space, since male and female spaces were considered vital parts of social ordering. Secondly, socially sanctioned violence performed by women challenged Euro-American ideas of natural female characteristics. It was hardly compatible with other descriptions that firmly, and conveniently, placed Indian women alongside their white counterparts. Thirdly, that such violence should display the reason, structure, and logic attributed to male violence would have been to locate women as social and intellectual equals of Indian males. Finally, violence that had meaning beyond the taking of a life.